Hello and welcome to the Coast to Coast College Admissions Podcast. Each week, we talk about different college admissions topics and answer those tough questions you may be dealing with concerning getting into the college of your choice. We know how difficult this process can be, so each week, we try and make it easier to navigate. Now, here's your host, Anna Wren and Mark Huffer.
Greetings and welcome to Coast Admissions Podcast number 7, Financial Aid Resources, or something I think we've lovingly titled as Going to School on OPM, and I think we'll talk a little bit more about what that means in just a bit. My name is Mark Huffer, and I'm here with
Anna Wren.
Hi, Anna. I hope you're well out there on the East Coast. We've had quite a weather week here in the Northwest, with more snow in the mountains than I think we've seen in over a decade.
Wow, we're just the opposite here on the East Coast. We're kind of enjoying this slightly warm weather that we've been having, and no snow.
And no snow, yeah. I think we might as well dive right in and talk a little bit about financial aid, since it is a timely subject now that I think a lot of students have identified the colleges that they've applied to, and some of them have heard back early which ones they're going to attend to next year. But also identifying best fit schools is going to be on everybody's mind. They'll be hearing about acceptances here in the next month or two. And I think one of the big stressors is off with all the applications, but a new stressor is probably on their minds, and that's who's going to pay for all of this? What do you think?
Oh, that's such a great point. And you know what's funny is, like, typically this is the time when I think we used to get all the financial aid questions, because the FAFSA, which we'll talk about a little later, usually opens on January 1st of the year. So it's open much earlier now, but you know, it's still on everyone's mind is, how am I going to pay for college?
Exactly. And I think that's one of the issues. I think it's good to know that financial aid is a moving target and that it's changing. And I think we'll talk a little bit more about that. You have to stay up to beat, and you have to know what kind of changes have taken place, and so that you're on top of it and can get the best possible package. We mentioned that we call this OPM, and I want to give a little bit of background. My wife's a financial advisor, and about 2 decades ago, she told me that she, when she's working with parents and they talk about paying for college, she says, well, it's best to go on OPM. And I asked her, well, what's OPM? And she said, that's known as going to school on other people's money. So I think that's one thing to keep in mind. That's what financial aid is all about.
Absolutely. And I think, if, in case anyone's wondering, it's all legal. It's all money that, you know, you can actually access. And I actually went to college on OPM as well. But, you know, let's dive in and talk about, you know, the different types of aid available and, you know, money available for people. Because everyone, I think, thinks that they look at colleges and it can cost, I think, private, you know, all in cost is anywhere from $60,000 to $70,000 a year right now, which is so mind blowing for some parents these days. And, you know, the idea that you would have to pay sticker price, you just wonder, like, oh my goodness, like, if I sold my house, would I even have enough money? So let's dive in and kind of talk about the different types of money out there for people to kind of, you know, grab at.
Absolutely. I think you mentioned one of the biggest fears that people have is they see that big ticket price, and then they look at, you know, what finances are available to them. And that difference is so overwhelming that I think a lot of kids won't even consider college in some cases, and won't consider colleges that they have every right of applying to. So I think it's best that they know what kind of money is available to them, and different ways to obtain it. So I think the two biggest ones, the two most common things that people talk about are government loans, and those come in a couple of different flavors. They come in subsidized and unsubsidized versions. And one of the main differences is, in a subsidized, it means that the government is basically going to be kind enough to pay the interest while you're in school. And then unsubsidized is one that immediately starts accruing interest. And even though it's a low interest, it will start the day that you start school or the day that you receive the loan. So that's one of the main ones is the subsidized and unsubsidized government loans.
That's a great point. And I think it's most important to kind of bring up loans first, because with the ballooning college debt, you know, you think about, you hear the news and it says like there's over $1 billion in student debt. And you wonder, how did it get there? But you raise a good point about interest. And I think as students sometimes, and as families, we're not always sure of the terms we sign up for, which is why it's really important that if loans are part of the financial aid package, that you think about, you know, when is that interest accruing? And for subsidized loans, like you said, it's great because the government covers the interest while you're in school. But most loans are not subsidized, and not everyone qualifies for a subsidized loan too, which is something to keep in mind. So, you know, coming up with a strategy as to how you at least cover the interest while you're in school, I think is important. Do you know what the actual current interest rate is, Mark, right now?
Yeah, it's funny. I think that number came out just recently, and for 2017, it's 3.76. So that percentage applies to unsubsidized loans immediately. So you're paying, and that's accruing at 3.6. And then subsidized loans after you've graduated, usually about 6 months, but that's not cut in stone. Usually it's about 6 months after you graduate, then it starts accruing interest.
And you're limited in terms of how much you can borrow, correct?
Yeah, and that's one of the tricky little things that I think most parents, when they find out how much, a lot of times you'll hear parents say, well, I paid my way through college, so can my child. And I think one of the things that they don't realize is taking out loans, if you take out the max subsidized and max unsubsidized loans over 4 years, it's only $31,000. So if the ticket price of your college is different than that, you're going to have to come up with the money somewhere else.
That's a great point. So where else can we come up with the money, Mark?
Yeah, the good ones. So there's one grants, which is money you do not have to pay back. And these are great because the money's tax-free. You don't have to declare it as income. And the grants come from federal, state, government, a lot of times, but also colleges provide grants. They're a great resource for free money, as it were.
That's a great point you raise. And I think it's very common to even see grants more with with private schools, because I feel like a lot of families shy away from applying to private institutions because they look at the sticker price. But the thing they don't realize is, depending on your family situation, is that they have a large endowment, so they have the money to give out grants. And, you know, we'll talk about it a little bit also when it comes to like applying for financial aid, but, you know, sometimes a school can make up their package and, you know, in different forms, and one of them is through grants.
Absolutely. And you mentioned endowments, and I was recently, I visited the University of Chicago, and I noticed their endowment is pretty staggering. They have a $7.6 billion, that's with a B, billion-dollar endowment. And what that allows them to do is they have resources available to students that they can use. And you know, grants are one of the ways that they can provide that to students who have incredible potential and they want them to come to the school. So there are a number of private and public schools that are able to provide some pretty astounding amounts of grants.
It's a great point. And in addition to grants, you know, some schools also offer scholarships, and they don't always come through the schools themselves, but they can also be independently as well, like sometimes offered through companies or other private parties. So what would you say about scholarships?
Yeah, scholarships. One of the things that people really need to understand about scholarships is the only way you can get one is by applying. So, if you don't, I mean, you can't play. You can't win if you don't play. So, applying is the first step. But it's also free money, and most scholarship money is available through different resources. But, you know, while there's a lot of money that's available through schools and other outlets and organizations, there's also philanthropic resources available as well. So things like companies may have specific scholarships. So if a student has a parent who works at a company, that's one of the first places they actually should look for a scholarship opportunity.
And don't, I would say the other thing is, don't just only look at large companies, because a lot of local businesses will also give out scholarships through the high school. So, you know, they'll usually have you write an essay or something else like that. But those are also worth considering, because even though they might be $500, $500 can help you pay for books, you know, and all that money adds up.
Sure. I tell students that there's no difference between 10 $500 scholarships and one $5,000 scholarship. They both pay the same bills and can offer the same amount of debt resource. So it's not a matter of the size of it. It's how many at the total that you've accumulated.
And I would also add that for scholarships, they might work out better for people that also, you know, might not qualify for financial aid. And we'll talk a little bit about that later too, just because a lot of times they are based on merit and, you know, depending on how your grades are, things like that, you know, you might be rewarded for that through scholarships.
Exactly. That's one thing, the difference between grants and scholarships. A lot of scholarships, there may be certain ties to academic performance that you have to maintain. And it's really important that you know if there is a particular standard or GPA that is required so that you can reapply, that you are maintaining that, because you don't want to come to the end of a year and find out that you have no longer maintained what the requirements for that scholarship actually are.
Yeah, that's a great reminder, Mark. And I think there's one last piece of the puzzle, which is federal work study. And I don't always like to include federal work study as aid, but I think we do need to talk about it. And so why don't you first talk about what it is?
Sure. It's basically a federally subsidized program in which they identify someplace there at the campus that has a work opportunity that's available for students. It's part-time work. And they can basically use the money that they've accumulated towards school and expenses. But there again, as you know, going to school is a full-time job on its own. So have you ever had students who you've actually not shed the most positive light on that situation?
So I think for students, you know, especially if they're freshmen, I tell them, like, don't count on that money, only in the sense that you have to find the job yourself and apply for the job and then have the time to work the job in order to get the money. And I can speak to that personally because I had tried federal work study and it was very difficult to try and do something my first semester at school as a freshman. But, you know, later on, I was able to access those funds. But the idea is that federal work study is not a guarantee, because you have to obviously earn it. So it's not guaranteed to go towards your books or your expenses. So I think that's just something to keep in mind.
Exactly. One of the things I tell students and parents as well, and much like you found out, especially in that first year, you're learning a new game and you're learning new habits and behaviors to be successful in school academically, as well as socially, and to be happy and get enough sleep. So adding that additional work to it can really throw a curveball into the whole situation. One of the things that I do, and it's directly, you know, it directly is in line with scholarships, in that if you are able to get a couple of scholarships that provide you with enough money, and that offsets money that you would have gained under the, you know, federal work study program, that is time that you can use studying as opposed to working. So there again, applying for scholarships, a lot of them, is going to be much to your advantage further on the next year.
That's a great point, Mark. So let's talk a little about, you know, because we've been kind of glossing over like financial aid and the FAFSA and all these terms. So let's take a step back and actually talk about, well, how does a family apply for financial aid? And we talked a little bit about financial aid versus scholarships, which is sometimes called merit aid. So how do people apply for these different types of, I guess, money resources?
Right. And I think that's one of the things that we all hear about, you know, financial aid. And I think it throws students and parents for a loop in that it's kind of out there as this amorphous thing, and it's really not that scary. It's just it's a process that you go through to identify certain numbers that identify whether you're eligible for financial aid, and it really comes down to the first thing you need to do is fill out what's called a FAFSA, and it's the Free Application for Student Financial Need. And basically that form allows you to fill out pertinent information that the government looks at, and they identify whether you're going to be eligible for financial aid or not. But if you don't fill it out, they can't give you that number, and a lot of people don't realize that financial aid is available to everyone, and almost everyone applies, and everyone who applies is going to get some type of financial aid, maybe not through the government, but maybe through the school, and they need to know that that form and filling it out is primary.
Yes, and all schools, I believe, require the FAFSA, and like Mark said, it's free. So there's really no downside to filling it out. And, you know, if anything, I know that this past year they've tried to make it easier to fill out so that it's not such an arduous task for families. And the other thing they've done, and I think this is thanks to the Obama administration, is they've actually realigned the process. So that instead of applying January 1st, now they apply, the application opens October 1st.
Right, and that aligns with the early, basically people who want to apply early, and you can actually fill it out early, and it's highly encouraged to fill it out early. For those people who want to know and just want to see what the process is like, there's a really great video I just stumbled on. And if you type into any browser, if you just type the 7 easy steps to filling out the FAFSA, it is a really quick video that outlines exactly what kind of information you're going to have, you need to have at hand in order to fill out the FAFSA. And it's really straightforward, quick, and if you have first questions, that's a great place to look.
What a great resource. And we'll include the link on the page later with this episode. So the other thing to keep in mind is, in addition to the FAFSA, there is another form that some schools require, which is called the CSS profile. And unfortunately, that form is not free. but I do encourage, and we encourage families to remember to look at the financial aid page of each school to determine, you know, the exact process for applying for financial aid.
Exactly.
But which aid do you think, I guess, works out for different types of people? Like, which type of family would benefit from financial aid versus merit aid?
Sure. I mean, I think all families benefit in those cases where you've got students who have been academically performing at the highest level and their families may not be in a position to be able to pay for college partially or fully. Those students, definitely, for them not to apply, especially at specific schools, and apply for merit aid, that is, it's one of the easiest ways and easiest routes to money for them to offset school costs, and they definitely need to look at those.
That's a great point you raise. And the other thing I would keep in mind is I talked with some people, and I don't know if you've ever had this happen with your families, where I'll have families tell me, I'm not even going to apply because I won't get any money through the FAFSA.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, on average, how many times do you hear that a year?
I feel like it's a blessing that I hear that, but at the same time, I feel bad at the same time because I'm like, oh, you're in such a bind, because they feel like they are going to be stuck paying sticker price. But I hear about it, like, I would say 50% of the time. How about you?
Yeah, especially for those people who are, they're blessed with making a very nice income as a family. They assume immediately that they aren't eligible for financial aid. And so they say, well, why do I even fill it out? And the thing is, a lot of times schools, you're eligible for financial aid, whether, you know, it's not based on need. And so your student may actually pull in quite a bit of financial aid. And I mean, if a school is going to give you $20,000 based on just applying and filling out a form, who's going to give it? I mean, it would be silly to pass up $20,000.
I would absolutely agree. But I do know, like, sometimes, like, for those, like, I remember seeing, like, around, I guess it comes out around April, where you see those articles where, like, oh, all these kids got into the, all these amazing schools, these Ivies, and then they turn down all of them, and they go to their state university because it's completely free. And I think it really depends on each family situation, because sometimes, you know, they would have to pay a lot more to attend those private universities versus accepting a full ride from their local state university. But I think that speaks to fit a little bit. So what do you think, like, what kind of challenges do you face when you work with your families as it relates to money and fit?
You bet. Yeah. I mean, and that's the thing. I think today, if you're not evaluating best fit, and one of the components of that evaluation is directly related to the financial cost and the burden that long-term debt provides, not only a student or and their family, but just how long that is going to take to pay back. If you're not actually factoring that into a best fit school, you're just doing yourself a huge, you know, it's just such a huge debt to take on when you know that there are different opportunities available. You mentioned state schools, and I think that's one thing that the research that's been done and collected shows that those people who actually go to school in their state, their earning power over time is better than if they go out of state. And it's just basically because of the network they're in. And they know the people and they know the area. And a lot of times that's where they also work. This isn't always the case, but the statistics will suggest that going to school at a state school, a local school, is going to actually over time be a financially good decision.
That's a great point you raise. And how would you say, like, you know, we're talking about the FAFSA and how you fill it out, but some families I know are probably thinking, well, what is it based on? And it's based on the income of the parents and the students, the assets of the parents and the students. But, you know, how can we make this tangible for families? Like, what do you recommend parents do to see if a school is a good financial fit for them?
You bet. One of the first things you have to do is identify how much the school actually costs. And I think they call it, it's called the COA, or cost of attendance. That's one of those acronyms you'll see as COA. And basically that cost of attendance is how much it will cost you, really cost you, to attend the school for 4 years. And it gives you an idea of everything that's included with tuition and fees and books and supplies, room and board, and all of the other things, including personal expenses and transportation as well. It doesn't include, you know, the purchase of a new puppy or juggling classes, but it does cover everything. And that allows you to know what the, as you mentioned, the total retail sticker price. Now, from that number, basically you find out how much a family, it's called their EFC, or their expected family contribution. So if you take, and I basically, in short, I put it as the school will cost you X, your family can pay Y, and the difference is how much you need, and that's X. And basically those factors will allow you to know how much you're going to have to be on the hook for when you graduate.
Yes. And some schools, I believe a lot in the top 40, actually try to meet 100% of financial need. But I think the thing to keep in mind, and they meet this need through OPM, but one of the pieces that is part of the financial package is loans sometimes. So that's just something to keep in mind, I think, for families. But, you know, you can always do more research and find out, like, how much need the school meets on average for its students by visiting their financial aid page.
Yep, and I think one of the numbers that it recently came out, I think for the graduating class of 2016, the average student debt country, the average student debt was $42,000.
It's just mind-blowing. And we think, like, oh, $42,000, I'll pay that off in no time. But, you know, I don't know if that's really the reality. It depends, I guess, on your job and other factors.
Well, do you? One of the things I talk about with students is basically earning power of what they hope to go into, and actually using that as a number to realistically apply how much debt they're going to take on, how long it's going to take to pay it back, based on how much their particular occupation is generally going to pay per year. Do you use that with your students?
We do talk about it, and I think it's personally important. I try to drive the, because I feel like students get really excited about the actual like application process, even though stressed at the same time. But the money part, I don't know that they're ready for typically. But I like to have those conversations, because as someone who is actually still paying their student loans, you know, and didn't quite understand everything that it entailed, I think it's important to think about, well, how will I pay this back? How will I have enough money to pay it back, and how quickly can it be done? And trying to understand the role that interest plays in that.
Right. I think one of the associated conversations with that is a lot of people have, it's come out that a couple of the Ivies for the last couple of years, over 60% of their graduate population, graduating population, has gone into either business or finance. And you look at that and you go, well, they're in it to go make money. Well, that actually is true. But the thing is, we also have to understand that a lot of times the debt that is going to be taken on by a student who goes to one of the Ivy Leagues may be so daunting that mm-hmm. they're looking at occupations which will allow them to pay that debt back. And it's a two-edged sword.
That's a really great point you raise. I actually have a friend who had some debt from undergrad and then went on and got two graduate degrees at Columbia, accrued more debt. So her debt, it was somewhere in the six figures. But, you know, as part of it, she picked a job in finance because she knew she'd be able to pay it back. And with a lot of effort, you know, family effort, scrimping and saving, she managed to pay off her debt in, I think, less than 4 years, a six-figure debt. So I give her a lot of credit, but, you know, I think that is not the norm necessarily. But, you know, at the same time, you're right. You know, now she can enjoy her future. But I know for a lot of, you know, students that are concerned because they're trying to think about, like, well, if I'm stuck paying this debt, will I be paying this debt until my kids go to college too? And for some families, that is the case.
Exactly. I think I've talked with a number of students who usually it's about the junior year. If they, like you say, you've had the conversation with your students prior to school and looking at school selections, but it doesn't soak in at this point, but usually around junior year, it's amazing how many students, when they're really setting into, identifying what career path they're going to take, then the student debt issue and that, you know, metric really starts to function in to which choices they're making for classes and for future occupations, because they know that debt is going to be needed to be paid off.
And how often has a financial aid package determined where a student goes to school for you?
Oh, that's interesting. I try to have the reality check and put things in perspective. I think it is more real for parents because I know they have a much better grasp of long-term debt and what that really means than I think teenagers do. But I've also run into a number of teenagers, two who are in school this year, who made their decision to go to state schools, even though, like you mentioned earlier on, they got accepted to a number of private Ivy League schools, but they realized the debt was not something that risk was not something they really wanted to take on.
That's a great point you raise. And the only reason I ask that is because I know that question came up even when my brother and I applied for school. And we ended up obviously we did the research and found schools that were all good fits for us. But in the end, the school we ended up picking just ended up being the one that incurred the least amount of debt.
Yeah, I was actually like, really I was really lucky in that I went to a state school. I actually went to a state school, got accepted to other schools, and for very much the financial reason, was able to graduate debt-free for undergraduate work. And then that allowed me to go to a private college for my master's and my doctorate. And I was paid off with those by the time that I graduated in both of them. So I wouldn't have been able to do that if I would have had this, you know, had assumed a huge debt as an undergraduate student.
That's such a great example, Mark. Wow. I feel like very few people I know have done that.
Well, and I think students, that's one of the things that if they realize they don't incur that debt early on and they're able to get a job after school without debt, that actually puts them in a great position for graduate school. And a lot of people can actually save money and go to graduate school at the same time. And in addition, there is a lot of scholarships, and this is a whole nother podcast, is talking about financial resources that are available to graduate students and scholarships.
Absolutely. So what would you say are the main takeaways for families as it relates to affording college and going to college using other people's money?
You bet. I think, well, one of the main takeaways for anyone is to understand that anything you can do to graduate with less debt when you graduate is a really good thing. And if you do that through scholarships and if you do that through grants, anything to chip away at that end amount that you are responsible for that will be in basically accruing a percentage every year, anything you can do to chip away at that is really a good focus.
That's a great point. And I think some of the things we've covered is it's best, obviously, to go with grants or scholarships, things that you don't have to pay back, money you don't have to pay back. The only thing I would caution is sometimes the private scholarships, sometimes that'll actually chip away from financial aid you might receive from the school, but it just depends how much you get. And that kind of, that equation, if you will, is constantly changing. But what if people can't get grants and scholarships or enough of that? What do you think they should go after next?
Well, if they can't get grants and scholarships, if you go down the totem pole and loans, basically, if they can't get if they've exhausted their subsidized and unsubsidized loans to the max, and then they have, and they aren't able to get scholarships or grants, then, they're looking at external sources. They're looking at sources that will probably be paying or will be charging a percentage interest that is much higher than they would have for the federally available loans.
That's a good point. And, you know, actually, I had an unsubsidized loan, so I was very grateful for that. So, you know, anytime you can get those, they're great. And I think the main thing to keep in mind is just apply for those scholarships. Some are part of the application process. And I know some are also part of honors programs offered at schools, but there's also other private scholarships.
Exactly. And every penny that you are able to bring in as scholarships or grants is directly related to, you can buy gelato with it. You can go out on the town and see a movie, for gosh. I don't think that anybody realizes that any money you bring in through grants and scholarships is just basically money that you won't have to pay and that you can actually use in different ways.
That's a wonderful thing to kind of remind people.
Especially this gelato.
A gelato. Who doesn't love gelato, right?
Exactly.
I think I actually spent some of my money from a federal work study on gelato. But any other imparting notes?
Yeah, I think one of the things that really becomes evident when you start looking at the history of our financial aid system, especially federally and even state and with private colleges, is to stay on top of it. The changes are, they happen daily for all intents and purposes. A lot of things at the federal level change every 4 years. So you have to stay on top of what's available and what's changing. The percentage rate changes. It's directly tied to what's called the 10-year government note. And that you know, that fluctuates. And then also individual schools, there you have to understand that those schools with alumni who have particular missions and want to support students who have particular interests, they provide, you know, scholarship merit money that's directly available to their particular interests. And students need to know what's available at their particular schools. And that changes every year.
That's true. And I think you mentioned this too, but actually even federal financial aid changes happens with each presidency too, such as the earlier FAFSA application date. So, and I think the other thing to keep in mind is always just, I think, I don't know if you tell your students this too, try to apply as soon as possible.
Oh yeah. I mean, the earlier you apply, you know, in some cases, schools have a known amount of money that they're able to give away. And if they know that the coffer is full and your application is one of the first ones they see, that provides them a little bit more leeway in what they're available to provide.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, even we've heard from admissions folks who have said that if financial aid is going to be very important for your family, then definitely apply early because there is that pot of money, if you will. And, you know, there's more of it in the beginning than there is later on.
Exactly. So, Anna, what's the most common questions that you hear from either students and parents regarding financial aid?
I think one of them is definitely, do I have to apply? And I tell parents, even the ones that are so blessed that they make so much money, that it's still best to apply, even if you don't need the money, only because sometimes financial situations can change. And if you at least filled out the FAFSA and the school has a record of it, then should your family's situation change, they can kind of pull out your application and kind of work with the family to update it. If your child is already in school and something happens. And I know that's something that, well, I think from FAFSA have actually told us at conferences before is you should still submit it even if you don't really need it.
Agreed.
How about you?
I think there's those are definitely some of the front of mind questions that I hear from parents for sure is, do I have to apply? And then one of the other ones that I commonly hear is regarding scholarships, and that's basically parents saying, you know, our son or daughter is working really hard this year. Is the amount of time that they're going to spend filling out applications for a scholarship, is that actually, you know, a good thing, and is it worth their time? And I always tell them, I said, you know, there again, you go over the cost of school and graduating with the least amount of debt, and you show how that interest, you know, quickly adds up, and you show that, you know, scholarships, a lot of the information that's available that they ask for on the application is directly related to questions that they've already answered on college applications anyway. So you can get a twofer and not have to, you know, write a completely different essay. And there again, the more you apply to, the more chances your likelihood of receiving one of them.
All great advice, Mark. Because I feel like some students get to the end of the journey and they're like, I just don't want to fill in any more applications or write any more essays. But I think, you know, like you said, it's definitely worth it to be able to kind of, even if it gives you a slight jump on life in the real world, whether it be for graduate school or like some of my peers are struggling with like deposits for their first home. So, you know, anything to help chip away at future debt is worth the effort.
Totally agree. So if there was one thing that you really wanted students to understand about financial aid and how it applies to them, is there one thing that you would have them focus on?
I would say don't focus on the sticker price. Especially this is very common for, I think, first generation students, is they automatically dismiss a school just because they don't think they can afford it. And, you know, I would say still, you know, if anything, if you don't know how much you're going to pay, leverage the net price calculator available on every school's website, because sometimes it is a reality. Sometimes going to an amazing school that you're interested in can happen. How about you?
Well, I'm gonna steal another one pieces of wisdom from my wife, the financial advisor, and I think for anything, just the rudimentary understanding of compound interest, and how that when we hear a percentage that a loan is going to be accruing, you know, debt. I think understanding how compound interest works, and that it isn't just a linear function, that you really need to have a handle on long-term debt and what that really means over time.
I think that is such valuable advice, because I don't think people really understand what that means. I know I sure didn't.
Exactly.
When I signed up for my loan, I'm like, oh, it's only this much. And here we are like 7 years later and I'm still paying it off, but that's okay. But no, I think that's a great point. And you know, if there are, I think they're working on courses on understanding loans, but if there's anything I think where students and families can do that before they accept a loan, they definitely should.
Agreed. Anything else on financial aid?
I think that's it. Next time we'll have to cover affording graduate school or something.
Oh my gosh, that's a whole nother can of worms, isn't it?
It is. But thank you so much for your time, Mark.
Thank you, Anna. It was wonderful to talk with you as always. And we will hopefully help some students find their best fit school, including financial aid and the best fit for that.
Thanks for listening to the Coast to Coast College Admissions Podcast, where we make getting into college easy and fun. Don't forget to go over to iTunes and subscribe to get updated each week when we release a new episode. Also, for more helpful college admissions information, visit our website at www.c2ccollegepodcast.com.